Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Martin Clark. He's out with a new novel, The Substitution Order. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Martin's a retired Virginia Circuit Court judge. He's written several novels, and this one is just an absolute thriller. It tells the story of Kevin Moore, who is a disbarred attorney in Virginia. He moves from Roanoke to Patrick County to work in a sub sandwich shop, and he becomes the target of a scam. Martin, just getting started into this book, what is it that has led Kevin Moore from his status as a criminal defense attorney into really a job that he'd ever probably expected to be in?
Basically, three bad months in his life that are not characteristic of how he has lived so far in terms of both his personal life and his professional life. He's disbarred, as you mentioned, and he is trying to put his life back together, his marriage back together, his career back together, and he has taken a job. The only job he can get is one of the interesting things that you probably have some sense of. If you're in the judicial system and you have a pending felony, you have a felony conviction, your job opportunities are limited. Kevin says he can do either construction work or I can go to work in a restaurant, and I choose the restaurant because I won't have to offload concrete in wicked heat. So there he is from the legal world, and he is he's making sandwiches in a cut rate sub shop, trying to prove himself to the bar and get his life straightened out.
And then the whole action of the book starts when he gets a mysterious visitor. They want to get him in on this scam, and I thought it was a very brilliant scam from a fiction standpoint. I don't know about from a realistic standpoint, because it sounds like it's fraught with problems, but I don't know how much you want to give away of that. But the scam, I thought, was just a brilliant literary tool.
Well, thanks for saying that. I was in St. Louis recently on book tour at the library there, and I tried to explain the scam with someone who had read the book, and as you get into it, and I tried to explain it very succinctly, it seemed hard to do. I don't know if that's a good selling point or not for reading the book, but suffice it to say, it has its roots in a real estate scam with inflated market values, and it actually is a cousin to something I had seen as a judge. So it's not totally fictional. I had a similar case as a judge, folks basically using shell corporations to inflate the value of real property. And then you have a vulnerable lawyer in this case, and he's accused of not exercising an option to buy the land, and the plaintiff's claim, or the scam artist's claim in this case, that he's responsible for all the profit they lost in the exchange.
Well, I'm sure as a judge, you've seen attorneys who've gone through periods in their lives similar to Kevin Moore, where you have something happen and it affects your law license or whatever. So was it difficult for you to climb into the head of Kevin Moore and assume what somebody might be going to when your professional license is taken from you?
It really was not. Probably in every bar there's a superstar. I know when I was coming along as a young lawyer, there was a really gifted attorney in the jurisdiction next door to us who became tangled up with drugs, ended up in the penitentiary. And recently in my own bar, there was a younger lawyer who took that same sad path. So I have seen it and been very close to it. I certainly have a lot of empathy for anyone in suffering those circumstances. So it wasn't particularly hard for me to get there. I know what you're going to have to do. I know how I think anyone can sense how humiliating and difficult it would be. So it wasn't really that hard for me to do. It was a nice feeling as I walked through to think that, you know, this hasn't happened to me yet and won't happen to me because I'm retired now. But I don't think it's an uncommon situation in it, and I don't think it's an aberration. Probably in every bar there's one person who has some hardships.
You know, as I read the book and I got to appreciating the setting as a character in and of itself. Kevin's living in a rural setting, and I know you live in a rural setting, and so I guess that's a good way for attorneys to clear their heads and things, and maybe things would have been different for Kevin had he had that setting in the first place. But can you kind of describe how you set it up in the book, this rural setting, and were able to capture these ideas so effectively on paper?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, and not everybody does. In all of my books, my hometown and the spot in which I live, Patrick County, is sort of a character, and I say that that part of the world becomes a character, and it is a very unique place, Patrick County. And this book, Kevin ends up, we call it the mountain. He lives on the mountain in Meadows of Dan, Virginia, and it is very rural but very neighborly. It is a different kind of place, and it is the place where people still do not lock their doors. They know each other, they help out, they pitch in, and it's changing, it's eroding a little bit, I think, just like the rest of the world. Someone asked me why is that happening, and I don't know. I'm not the person to ask about why sort of the atmospherics are changing or what we need to do to fix it. But Patrick County is a very unique place. He lands there. And if you were looking to clear your head and to stay away from temptation and to be surrounded by good people, this would be a good spot to land.
Well, and I loved the idea that you brought in. There's a dog at the sub shop where he lives. And I know animals are near and dear to your heart, especially dogs. But the dog, bringing that dog in as a character, and it was very prevalent because he kept going back to it. And, you know, a lot of people might say, well, that's just an extra character. No, it actually meant something because it showed the heart of Kevin Moore, that he's not a bad guy.
Yeah, and my editor, Gary Fiskejohn, said it's almost cheating if on page 8 or 9 you have the fallen protagonist who's sort of flawed, climb into a dumpster, rescue a puppy, and raise the puppy and take care of him. He says, if you want to make someone likable, that's kind of cheating. But it's important, I think, for readers. Readers are not going to pull for a villain necessarily, and readers are not too interested in a character with really, really complicated flaws if that character returns to the bad habits and the bad choices again and again. So it is emblematic. Nelson is the dog's name, and he is certainly emblematic of what a good person Kevin is. And long-term plot-wise, some of the clues he does with the dog, Kevin does with his dog, becomes really integral to the tie-up part of the plot.
Well, I'm chatting with Martin Clark about his brand new novel, The Substitution Order. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold, and it's just a great thriller to round out your summer reading season. When you write a book about an area where you know so well from living there, Patrick County, that area, how do you walk the line of making it too hyper-local so that only the real local people will appreciate it versus something that's going to appeal to a mass audience?
That's an interesting question. I use real names in the book. One of the characters, Ward Armstrong, and that name for a lawyer, for a high-flying, really skilled lawyer, seems almost fictional. So if you're reading it in Sioux City, or you're reading it in Michigan, or you're reading it in Austin, it just seems like a name, and it almost seems so colorful as to be made up. There is a real Ward Armstrong, and the reason I do that is if you're reading the book locally or regionally even, and you come to a name, and it's not a real name, it's a fictional name, it will, I think, jar you and throw you out of the story and bump you out of the narrative. And I think it's difficult as a reader, if I live in Patrick County or I live in Martinsville or I live in Virginia even, And I come to a name in the story or a place in the story, and it's not authentic, if it's not bona fide, then it just stops me in my tracks. So there's that bit of local appeal, and that's why I do it. However, if you're reading it somewhere else, it's just another name, and it doesn't make a bit of difference in the world. Many of the characters, while they have real names, the composite character is different than the real character. The character in the Substitution Order is not the same as the person you would meet and shake hands with if you travel to Patrick County.
And then Judge David Williams, I believe, is a real character too, right?
He's my boss. I treated him well. I treated him well in the book. But that wasn't hard. He's a great judge, a smart guy. Been a pleasure to work, or was a pleasure to work with for 28 years. But yeah, he's a real person, and his portrayal in the book is pretty accurate. But then again, I'm in Santa Fe this morning, and I just got an email from one of my lawyers who'd read the book, and if that lawyer had read this book and the judge had been named John Smith, I think it would have made a difference in how he absorbed the book, how he perceived the story.
And to your judicial career, you obviously come across a lot of people, and you see things from the bench. When you were a circuit judge, is that I'm familiar with Virginia courts, is that a general jurisdiction judge?
We do everything from speeding tickets to capital murder cases.
Okay.
It's general.
So as you're observing people from the bench practice law, do you see a lot of bad lawyering and good lawyering? And is it kind of nice just to sit there and watch and be able to critique?
I don't know that I've ever, that's an interesting question. I don't know that as a judge I've ever critiqued people sort of consciously as a trial is ongoing. At the end, if a lawyer needs to improve something quietly and in my chambers, I certainly will mention that to the lawyer. I came from a pretty good bar. One of the interesting things about my bar, some of the best lawyers I have are in my public defender's office. They have a roster of 4, 5, 6 lawyers. I don't know how many people in that office now. And I would let any of those lawyers defend me. The one thing that's interesting to me, and I don't know if you've had this experience or not, there are lawyers who come with all kinds of accolades and the reputation of being a giant killer, and in fact they aren't. So-and-so is a really great lawyer, and he or she may be competent, but really not that great. I'd say that's sort of the disconnect I've seen in terms of perhaps critiquing people.
Did you get to the point on the bench where you could anticipate that, oh, there's going to be an objection to this question, or wow, I would have objected to that?
Yeah, I think everybody does. I mean, that's part of the job. You look around the corners, and sometimes the good lawyers are well ahead of me. I mean, they're 3 or 4 steps past me. One of the lines in that I wrote in the book is that a good lawyer can turn on a dime, but a great one doesn't have to because he's already headed in the right direction.
I remember that. That's a great quote. This book was reviewed in the New York Times, and you didn't get just any schlub to review it. Alifair Burke, best-selling author, writes books with Mary Higgins Clark as well as her own, reviews it. You sitting there as somebody that didn't become a writer by trade, but you've become one now, and you sit and read a book of yours reviewed by Alifair Burke, who's this famous author that everybody knows. What's that do to your mind?
It's really pretty amazing to me. I don't know how much of my background, I struggled for 20 years to get published. I had 22 decades of rejection letters, and one of the fun things I usually do at my book gigs is I read them. I read those rejection letters, and they are just pointed. Some of them are funny, and I always say, and I say, well, it's not because I'm bitter, and that I've held on to the actual letters. I guess how long would that be? My first book was published in 2000, so almost 40 years of letters that I have, some type of using an old manual typewriter and whiteout. So I had 20 years of rejection letters. I had an agent who said it only takes one in this business. You need one person in the publishing house to like the book, and you need a couple of people in the publicity world to like the book, and that can put you really into the stratosphere. And in my first book, The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living, I could not give away for 2 decades. And like many authors, I said, all I ever want to do is see it in print. If someone would just take it on and print it, I would be happy. And then Knopf took a chance on it in 1999, and it was published. And then in those days, the New York Times came to Patrick County, took my picture in the backyard with the cur dog and in the bare spots in my yard, and I've been off and running ever since. So here we are in 2019, with that scenario sort of repeated, and it's just absolutely mind-blowing to me. It's just wonderful. And Alla Fair Burke is a law professor, too.
Yes, she is.
Which made it even more gratifying to me that she got the book and said nice things about it. So it's, if you have 20 years of heartbreak and getting close and rejection and being kicked around, when you finally arrive, it's just really, really nice.
Well, and during the 20 years, you're rising in the legal profession. I mean, you rose to a circuit court judge, successful legal career. Does it keep you up at night during those 20 years thinking, why am I so successful in this profession and yet I can't get a bite in this other one? That's got a grain on you.
I never thought about it in those terms. I never compared the two career tracks. I like writing. I love writing. People like different things. People like playing golf. People like collecting stamps. People like composing music. Everybody, I love it. And so, and I often tell people that if you want to get into this gig, you really need to like what you're doing. You're not going to sort of superimpose your will on something you don't enjoy doing and become successful vis-a-vis writing fiction novels, I don't think. And so I enjoyed doing it. I loved it. I had to love it because I was just not getting anywhere. And I just kept my nose to the grindstone. And honestly, one of the reasons I always tell that story and read the rejection letters is because listening today and probably every group I've spoken to on book tour this time is somebody who is suffering sort of that same fate. And I hope that will be a little bit of encouragement.
All right. Well, and we are all the benefit of your hard work and getting to enjoy these books, and this latest one is no exception. The Substitution Order by Martin Clark. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good people at Knopf. Martin, fantastic talking to you about this book, and it was just a wonderful read, and thanks for joining us.
And thank you. Thanks so much. Enjoy chatting. I'm grateful.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weiser. We will be back next time.
Lawyers clean up all details since Daddy had to lie.